Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The overwhelming majority of us deal with banks on a regular basis. Even if we don't go inside of a physical bank, we use the ATM, we use our credit cards, maybe apply for a loan. But how many of us actually know how they work? What is their main function? What's the difference between an investment bank and a commercial bank? Where does their money come from? And how did they get so big? During the 2008 financial crisis, we were constantly told that the major banks were too big to fail. Well, here we are today, and they're even bigger. In 2011, Phil Angelides, chairman of the U.S. Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and former California state treasurer, said, quote, "These banks are too big to fail. They're too big to manage. They're too big to regulate. They're too complex to understand, and they're too risky to exist. And the bottom line is they offer very little benefit," end quote. But what does that mean exactly? Why are banks so powerful? And what changes have we seen after the last meltdown? On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the banking system. Today, we are joined by Timothy Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. He's currently writing a book about the Federal Reserve. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by Anat Admati. She's professor of finance and economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and she's co-author of The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. Hi, Anat. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So we decided to do this show because after we did a show a couple weeks ago about public banking, we were flooded with phone calls and emails from listeners who had questions about how banks actually work. So we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question about the banking system or just how a bank functions, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Anat, you're a professor at Stanford. When you talk to students and just people on a regular basis, what do you hear from them about banks? Do people understand how the banking system works?
I don't think a lot of people really understand. I think a lot of people want to, you know, go work for banks. They usually offer exciting careers and pretty good salaries. And so it's a popular career path for many people. Michael Lewis talked about that from Liar's Poker on, about how it sort of got to be so exciting to be in finance. But in terms of understanding what exactly all that's done, there was always investment banks. There were always commercial banks that make loans. But I don't think people really quite understand what's going on there. And it's not that hard, actually.
It's not that hard to understand.
No.
Because you often hear that it's just too complex. I mean, the quote that I read from Phil Angelides, they're too complex to understand and they're too risky to exist.
There are a lot of complicated financial products that got invented, and some of it just does get to be mathematical and otherwise complicated, all kinds of derivatives, and it's fancy this and that. And we do teach some of this rocket science, what you might call finance physics and rocket science. Yeah, so it gets to be so complicated that people around it even are sometimes not willing to admit they don't understand it. And then what you get is you get people with physics education or math education who don't quite see the big picture, and they're down in their little cubby developing some models and then believing that these models work under the assumptions that they made, and sometimes they get more confident. And we saw even in 1987 a big market crash, and also had to do with people believing their models a little bit too much. And so a lot of it can be explained. It does take a little more than a sentence to explain, but it's not hard. That's basically what we try to do in the book.
And Tim, what's your experience like in talking with your students and colleagues about how the banking system works?
I think a great many people think that it's quite complicated. I agree with what Anat said, that there are very complicated financial instruments, and quite often those who engineer these instruments, they may lose their shirts. It might be too complicated for them at times, you could say, as 2008 kind of suggested. But just the sort of nuts and bolts on what a bank is and what it does, I think is it's not all that complicated, but people assume that it's for the experts and not for themselves.
So how did banks become such an important part of the economy?
Well,
Anat.
Well, they're important because they do two things that can kind of have a hold on the economy. One is that they support basically a payment system, which you could think of as a road system, some infrastructure. We keep the money, we use the deposits that we put in the bank, which basically are part of how the bank funds what it does. So it's their debt to us. We put our money in the bank in deposits, and we use them to pay our bills. And so we have a way to pay, which does not involve cash and meeting the person, and we have ways to transfer money and pay with credit cards and all that. And that's part of the infrastructure. We want that to work. We want to be able to go to the ATM and get our money. When it got disrupted in Cyprus, you know, when you have bank runs, that's a problem. The other thing they do is from the beginning of time, and you might say, why is that? In fact, any money can be used to make loans, but they also lend. So they are kind of intermediating the putting savings into things. Of course, investments are made by lots of people and hedge funds and other all kinds of investors, private equity, everybody invests. But the banks invest. Now, where they can really make a difference in investment is some businesses, like small businesses, kind of end up borrowing from banks to fund their investments. And so by giving credit both to people to buy their homes and also to maybe to buy a car, but especially it's important when it's to invest, especially small businesses, then it depends on the banks. Now it depends on the banks doing it, and it depends on the banks wanting to do it versus choosing to do other things. And so part of the issues with banks, which we can explore more, is what we kind of need for them to do as an industry for the economy and how they can help and what they actually prefer to do.
Hmm. And before we get to that, Tim, what would you add to that? How did the banks become such an important part of the economy? Because we often heard and sometimes still do that they're just too big to fail, and we cannot let them go down because it would completely wipe out the economy.
Well, what's interesting is to look back several decades ago when the American economy was doing very well, that banks and finance were a smaller percentage of the overall economy back then. And as banking and finance has grown in its importance to the U.S. economy, the U.S. economy has performed worse, not better. How has that happened? A lot of it has been the lobbying and political clout of the big banks, and that they are now being run in the interests of their own shareholders and their CEOs, the top management class of these banks, but not really in the interests of the overall economy or for society at large.
And what do we need to know about the history of banking and how their function has changed? What would you say about the history of banking, Anat?
Well, if you think about banking, there's a long history of banking, of course. But if you want to start with deposits. Start in Europe, where the merchants were giving the banker the money in exchange for banknotes, for sort of IOUs that then they could pay with as they traveled around to trade. And so it starts with deposits. And then the banker decides to play with the money and goes and makes some loans. But if you go much closer to our age, 19th century, banks are like private partnerships, and they have the owners. It's not a corporation, because corporations were not as much around. And they, to be safe, they have to put their own money in. Otherwise, the depositors won't agree to give them money. And then they become corporations, and then they start having central bank help them if they can't, if they have some kind of a liquidity need. They need all of a sudden cash, but they invested in something that's not so liquid and convertible to cash easily, or all the depositors come at the same time. And then they also started fencing up their loans because they were always exposed to the risk of something happens to the loans or something happens to the interest rate, like what happens in the savings and loans. And all of a sudden, a lot of banks just failed because they needed to pay a high interest to their depositors, but they were only getting fixed low interest from the mortgage borrowers. And so all kinds of things can go wrong, even in traditional banking. And so they've always been some fragility in all of this that they fail, or they might lend to governments and all of a sudden the government can't pay them and they load up on those loans. So there are always incidents of that sort. But fundamentally, then they became more fancier in the ways that they could take risk and in the ways that they can hide that risk and in the way of how they got knotted up and interconnected in the last 30 or 40 years, and therefore in the way that they are able to kind of get bloated up and basically subsidized paradoxically to be bigger and bigger and bigger, and it works for them precisely as was said, and it works for very few people in the end of the day, and it really harms the public. And this is one of the things that's really the reason, for example, we wrote the book. Was very alarming that somehow this industry is not contained so it can do its job without harming and endangering.
And that's where regulation comes in, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
because
yes.
We're actually going to do a show about regulation next week.
Okay.
Because Senator Elizabeth Warren has been on this ever since she got to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And in terms of the primary function of the bank, Tim, can you talk about, you know, what was the primary function, say, four decades ago? And what's the primary function of a bank today? How has it changed?
Well, it has changed tremendously over these decades. I think the New Deal gave us a framework for banking where it was a much more regulated industry. And commercial banks, where we would park our deposits, had to become a safer industry as a result of this New Deal legislation. So the New Deal brought us deposit insurance, federal deposit insurance, so that it would prevent bank runs. We could have more assurance that our deposits would be there at the end of the day. But that does create a so-called moral hazard, perhaps, as they say, in which the bankers might be more tempted to play fast and loose with deposit funds. But the New Deal also gave us the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial banking from the stock market, from the securities industry. And banking had become a very safe but somewhat boring type of an industry for several decades until the deregulations that started in the 1980s. Interest rate deregulation begins with President Carter and President Reagan. But an awful lot of the deregulation actually occurs in the 1990s under President Clinton. And they sweep aside Glass-Steagall, allow the banks to, commercial banks, that is, to get much more heavily invested in riskier securities industry. They then deregulate the derivatives market, which adds an awful lot of complexity and risk to what the bankers are doing.
That is Timothy Canova, professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Sheppard Broad Law Center in Florida. He's currently writing a book about the Federal Reserve. We're also joined today by Anat Admati. She's professor of finance and economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and she's co-author of The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. And we'd love to hear from you. We did a show about public banking about a month ago, and we got a lot of calls about how banks actually function. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, we all deal with banks on a regular basis, using credit cards, ATMs, applying for a loan, maybe not walking into a bank, but maybe depositing a check directly, electronically. But do you know how a bank actually works? How do you choose a bank? How has your relationship with your bank changed over the years? And what questions do you have about how this system works? How do these banks get so big? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. yourcallradio.org. So, Anat, since Tim brought up the Glass-Steagall Act, this was passed during the Great Depression in 1933, which prevented commercial banks from trading securities with their clients' deposits. Before we talk about Glass-Steagall, why don't you first talk about the major differences between a commercial bank and an investment bank?
Well, right now it's all what's called universal banks, and this distinction sometimes is, you know, was mandated. And in Europe, it's they're depending on the country. There are some banks that do a variety of things, but the distinctions are not always in legal. Investment banking is fundamentally in the business of helping companies raise money, advising on mergers, and arranging kind of financial transactions for other corporations, for businesses, and like that. Commercial banks usually take deposits, so that's part of their functions. They have a sort of a service related to those deposits, such as what you mentioned, ATMs, which Paul Volcker said were for sure sort of an innovation in our lives, an improvement in our lives, the ATM. And of course, you added as well, and I would add as well, online banking. That's convenient, and so that's all fine. Now, what they then do, even before Glass-Steagall was abolished, it was so eroded because the small banks, the commercial banks, always moved their money to those money center investment banks anyway. And right now we have a lot of layers in between. People are familiar with money market funds, and basically they're just another layer in this interconnected system. They started because in the 70s there was regulation that forbade banks from paying interest on deposits, and meanwhile interest rates were very high. So the money market funds were an alternative where you can have like a checkbook, but you can make money on those deposits because they would be closer to the interest. Now, what did the money market funds do? They in turn lent to the banks, and right now they are kind of in the middle between, you know, us and the funding of some all kinds of banks around the world, because they're the ones that we put money in. We think it's pretty safe. They don't actually have deposit insurance officially, and then they go and invest it overnight or over for a short period of time in many other financial institutions, and then they, if they feel like something's wrong, they would sort of pull their money out, and we can run to the money market funds and move our money quickly to deposit if we get nervous. So they add a lot of also fragility and complexity to the system. So, and then the banks deal a lot with one another. So in other words, some of this complexity is hard to kind of put walls between, because there is the issue of sort of what the banks do with and how do they most efficiently diversify risk and kind of get what are they allowed to do with which kind of money.
And over the years, legislators and regulators chipped away at Glass-Steagall, and it was eventually repealed in 1999. And Tim, I mean, a lot of people say that contributed heavily to the 2008 financial crisis. How did the repeal of Glass-Steagall affect the banking industry?
Well, first, I agree with what Anat said, that even before 1999, Glass-Steagall had been seriously eroded, and you just alluded to that, through regulatory interpretations and the courts upholding the regulators' interpretations of Glass-Steagall. But 1999 really sweeps it aside. I think that, combined with certain other measures that were passed by the federal government, allowed the banks to get much more involved in the securities industry, and in particular mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations. These were the instruments that really destructed in the 2007-2008 financial meltdown.
Do you ever think that we'll get Glass-Steagall back?
Well, I support Glass-Steagall having it back. And, you know, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act tried to take a few steps in that direction with the so-called Volcker Rule. But this shouldn't be thousands of pages of complexity. The Glass-Steagall Act itself was a very short act compared to the pages and pages of rules and regulations that are being discussed to implement the so-called Volcker Rule that would prevent banks from engaging in proprietary trading. I think a Glass-Steagall Act doesn't have to be that complicated to start separating banks and their affiliates, commercial banks and their affiliates, from the securities industry. The problem is a political one, is that the banks have an awful lot of clout, and they don't want to be separated from the riskier activities.
Right. And again, we're definitely going to talk about that next week. We have a number of emails and phone calls, so let's hear from Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks very much. I have had an interesting time working with students in an English class at Laney College in Oakland, where we started a unit that included the film Inside Job, describing the 2008 crash, I guess. And I started by asking how many people understood the term mortgage. And these are smart, capable students, lots of life experience. But some of them have lived in a house that their family has owned maybe for a while. Others are, they've known nothing but renting. And I know this is anecdotal evidence, but about 2 out of 30 students had any idea what a mortgage was.
Hmm.
And it indicated to me how far people are from a really strong sense, understanding how finance works and understanding how banking works. Whereas by the time we got through with that film and a little bit of discussion and pausing with terms like derivative and collateralized debt obligation and trying to define those and make them tangible somehow, students were amazed, like one of your guests just said, that it's really not all that complicated. And I think sometimes the language that has developed in finance is almost a way of distancing it from people's lives, and I think our education system in general is not teaching people how to understand these things.
Were the students interested in learning more?
Oh, they were fascinated, and they were angry.
Huh.
They felt cheated. They felt like, you know, I talked about how I remember economics class. I was born in 1969. I had an economics class where we learned to balance a checkbook, at least. My wife talks about a home ec class, where they started learning about some really important kind of household financing type information.
Yeah.
And my students said, no, we don't have any of that anymore. There's no more home economics. And there's a lot of them don't have to take an economics class even.
Right.
And the ones who did were really disappointed that it pretty much stopped at the law of supply and demand.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Chris. Anat, your response.
Let me tell you something that you will be shocked by. There's a book called The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins, by Jeff Connaughton. He's now also in the Unraveling, is sort of another book by Packer. And he worked a lot. He was a staffer for Biden for many years, and then was a lobbyist, and then worked with Senator Ted Kaufman. Ted Kaufman was a very special senator because he filled Joe Biden's spot for 2 years when Biden was vice president, became vice president, and he did not run for re-election, which meant that he didn't need the money from Wall Street or anybody, so he wasn't. He didn't care what they thought. And in any case, Jeff, in his book, in the preface, says the following words, and this is quite to what you said. And I am shocked discovering a lot of what you're saying is right. The caller, which is, he says, unfortunately for the American people, Obama and Biden are financially illiterate. This is pretty shocking because they have pretty good education.
Well, and you know, Anat, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. And actually, I watched a video last night where another congressman said the same thing, that most politicians really don't know how this system works. Today, we are taking your calls and questions about banking, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a better program when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, here's the number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about summer reading. We'll open the lines to get your summer book recommendations. What are your new and old favorites? We'll also talk about the state of independent bookstores and talk about which one you support. Adobe Books in San Francisco was recently forced to relocate, and Marcus Books is fighting to stay open, the oldest black bookstore in the country. That's tomorrow. And then Thursday, we will talk about the state of gay politics and gay identity after the Supreme Court decision. It's supposed to come down tomorrow on Gay Marriage and the Defense of Marriage Act. We should have a ruling for sure by Thursday, so we hope you tune in for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Agenda for a New Economy series, and we are talking about the banking system. We did a show about public banking, about the one public bank in North Dakota just a couple weeks ago. We got a number of phone calls and emails about how the banks work, so we thought we would do a show focusing on this very question. How do banks operate? What is their main function? We all interact with banks on a regular basis, even if you no longer go inside of a bank or deal with people who work at a bank, but you still deal with them on a regular basis. So do you know how they work? What's your question? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you work with any group, students, or if you do sort of banking education, how do you go about it? What are some misconceptions? What are the main questions? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Tim Canova, professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Sheppard Broad Law Center in Florida. He's currently writing a book about the Federal Reserve. And Anat Admati is professor of finance and economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She is co-author of the new book, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. And Anat, before the break, you were talking about what it says in The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins, a book by Jeff Connaughton. Can you just repeat that sentence about what it says about President Obama and Vice President Biden?
I read this right after I finished my book. It's not quoted in my book. He says, unfortunately for the American people, Obama and Biden are financially illiterate.
So what did he mean by that?
Shocked. He means they don't really understand the system. So if you don't understand it, you're not alone.
Representative Ron Paul, who is always fighting for transparency with the Federal Reserve, said the same thing about politicians in D.C., that they really don't understand the system. Do you agree with that?
I was present in just one congressional hearing in the last few months, and I was shocked. People in the room didn't understand the topic that we were discussing at all, what the words meant that we were discussing. They didn't understand what the word capital means that they throw around all the time.
So what does that mean for the public? I mean, these are the people writing the laws.
It means that there's enormous number of confusions, and then it gets fancier and fancier. And so the title of our book is The Banker's New Clothes, which refers to lots of things people say that are just wrong, in various ways wrong. Either they're just kind of a story they're telling, a narrative, some kind of something they say, or some total nonsense, actually, that makes no sense at all. And yet they get away with saying it and with even impacting policy with these flawed claims. Hmm. And so once we unpack all of them little bit by little bit, starting with explaining indeed what a mortgage is, which the caller said people don't understand, and then all the way to what banks do and how they're regulated and what they say in their lobbying, which sometimes some of these things are said by other industries. Oh, we got to be competitive abroad and all of these other things. And then you understand how bad it is and how alarmed we are at this really, really inefficient and dangerous system that we are somehow allowing, not regulating effectively and allowing to get sort of to endanger us like that.
And in many cases, the banks actually write the laws, because the New York Times had a piece about Citigroup writing a law a couple weeks ago. And again, we will discuss that on our Tuesday show next week. But Tim, before we move on to other calls, Chris had a great example of showing his students Inside Job, and they were interested, they were angry. Do you have other examples of teachers and professors trying to educate students about the banking system?
Well, I could talk about my own experience in teaching a banking law class in a seminar on the financial crisis, and we had a film series at my law school at Nova Southeastern University, which included Inside Job and a few other films. And I think the reaction of these law students was very similar to what your caller described. It opened their eyes, a bit of outrage as to what had happened. It was like a revelation. You know, I think that he also, your caller described this financial illiteracy, and I think it is a failure of the school system and the mass media system as well. I mean, if you took a public opinion surveys, I'm sure you'd find that many more people, a higher percentage, know about the private lives of celebrities than about the financial system and their own financial conditions.
Yep.
And that's alarming, and that's a problem. And as we have high levels of this kind of financial illiteracy, it really does mean that the politicians and the regulators who make these laws and these rules are going to rely more and more on the industry themselves.
Yep.
You know, very self-interested industry perspective. So there's a cost to this illiteracy, and there really is.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Chris. And we've got full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. We're talking today about how the banking system works. And let's hear next from Dorothy. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you might discuss credit unions and how they differ from banks. I have all of my money in a credit union. I gave up on the banks a number of years ago. But I know that they don't engage in quite as the risky activities that regular banks do. But I thought that that would be a useful thing to talk about.
Okay, thank you. And Mary in Santa Cruz had the same question, but she couldn't stay on the line. Anat, do you want to take that one first? What's the difference between big banks like a Bank of America and a credit union?
Well, in the UK right now, there was a bank called Co-op Bank. And credit unions, I don't know everything about all the different kinds of banks. Legally, they are kind of slightly defined differently or incorporated differently or slightly regulated differently. So credit unions also take money from depositors and do some things with them. So fundamentally, like all corporations, banks take money from people, and the banks just differ in that they take some money from in the form of deposits that you can supposedly get to, but otherwise it's basically the same idea. They take money and they invest, and credit union may are probably more restricted in what the kinds of things that they can do with the money. But the key to all of banking is that they do often take risk with that money. And so unless they have a way to absorb the losses that might happen from those risks, they can be too dangerous. The Cyprus banks were not that complicated. The banks in Cyprus that failed, what they did was they promised depositors, you know, 4 or 5%, which was really very high interest rate in the environment that interest rates are very low. In Europe, you couldn't get that in Germany on deposit. And then they went and invested that in Greek government bonds. Well, the Greek government bonds were very, very risky. And that's why, just like credit card debt, they promised to pay 15 or 20%, which was wonderful life. All of us can be bankers like that. If you promise somebody 4% and you take their money and you invest it at something that pays you 15 or 20%, there's a wonderful spread there. Hmm. And it's a great life. And in the rest of finance, we call something like that an arbitrage opportunity if there was no way to lose at all. The problem is usually that when something pays 15 or 20%, which is also like credit card debt is not always paid, there's a chance they won't pay that 15 or 20%. And in fact, the Greek government had to restructure their government bond because they were couldn't pay it, couldn't collect taxes and all of that. And so all of a sudden, the Cyprus banks lost 75% of their investment in lending to the Greek government. Now, the regulation was so flawed that it didn't require them to prepare at all for the possibility of a loss on this investment. They could just invest only borrowed money in that. So even a credit union, if they have no owner's money involved in this, no like down payment, no equity, they too can be dangerous. But of course, their ability to scale the risk is much less than the big banks. And so individually, they also don't harm if they do fail. And so it becomes a matter of management, sound management every time you have money. MF Global failed. You know, you can always mismanage money.
And Tim, what would you say is the difference for the person who actually is doing the banking? Because there was that big Move Your Money campaign, and a lot of people took their money out of the big banks and put them into community banks or credit unions.
Yeah, well, community banks and credit unions, they make loans like big banks, but they traditionally make those loans directly to their members. They keep the money in the local community. The levels of concentration at this point have gotten so incredible where something like more than two-thirds of the nation's deposits and loans are in the top six or seven big mega banks. And those banks have no interest in keeping the money in the local communities where the deposits come from. So I do support that Move Your Money campaign. And what Anant said was also true, that it is certainly quite possible, and we've seen it happen time and again, where these other types of financial institutions like credit unions or community banks or savings and loans can be badly mismanaged. The S&L industry, the savings and loan industry, is a great example.
Right.
It had first been sort of locked into low-interest investments. It couldn't compete with the bigger banks when interest rates started rising above the regulated levels. Congress responded, this is in the 1980s, by deregulating the S&Ls and allowing them to get into incredibly riskier investments, and they couldn't handle it. So it led to the collapse of the industry.
All right. Well, thank you again for the question, Dorothy. And let's go next to Marco in Berkeley. Hi, Marco.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I developed a curriculum to teach about money and banking to activists and engaged citizens. And I'm frustrated by the fact that the conversation is missing a very important element, which is the money creation function of the banking system. When we think about banks as intermediaries taking in the deposits and lending them out, we are hiding the fact that money is created in the process of lending. And I would like your panelists to discuss that.
Can I take?
Sure, Anant.
This is one of the things that they want to sort of confuse you by, this notion of money creation. There are many ways to have aggregate counting of money, but the money creation only refers to the fact that the payment system kind of circulates the money around, and you can then add up all kinds of numbers to one to another. But banks, let me just make clear, this does not make banks creators of money in the sense that they have a printing press. No. What this refers to is the fact that when you give the bank, when the banks, the debt of the banks to their depositors is something that the depositors can use to pay, and so they use it as if it's money. So the fact that I can use my bank account as if it was $20 bill does not make the deposit the same as a $20 bill because of the following distinction. The $20 bill is nobody's debt, but the deposits are the bank's debt to you. That's the distinction. So from the perspective of safety and soundness, the key thing about deposits, and this was true before we had central bank money, meaning the $20 bill, which is sort of a piece of paper that everybody accepts, we had bank notes. And the bank note was basically an IOU from the bank. That's a deposit, is an amount of money. You just use the numbers. But it's still their debt, and it still remains an issue that they owe it, and it still is something that they don't want discussed much, but they still have to live within the amounts of money that people give them in exchange for promises to pay back. And when they take risk, the question becomes, who bears that risk, and can the depositor trust that the money is still there? If they take too much risk, then somebody's going to bear the downside if they can't. And that remains a problem. So you can talk about money creation all you want, but it doesn't change some of those facts that have to do a lot with safety and soundness. And the bank's money creation has to be taken into the context of the money they create is their debt, all private money is debt, somebody's debt.
Tim, what would you add to that? Because you often hear about money creation and the Federal Reserve.
Sure. Well, when the Fed creates money, what's it doing? It's adding liquidity into the banking system. It's adding monetary reserves into the banking system. There's a lots of different ways it can do that. One of the primary ways is it purchases bonds from the banks. The Fed creates the money out of thin air, essentially. It does it through computer. It's not this is digital. It's not a currency that's physically changing hands. And it makes an exchange for bonds from the banks, and that adds money into the banking system. What do the banks then do with it? The banks are able to then make loans. So I think Marco has a somewhat of a point when you talk about the fractional reserve banking system, which, if a bank makes a loan to you, how does it make the loan? It doesn't write a check and send it to you in the mail. It essentially tells you your account with us now has an extra $1 million deposited that we've just created for you. And then what do you do with the $1 million loan that you got to the bank? You start writing checks from your checking account. Whatever you are spending from that ends up in other people's accounts. And that's sort of the multiplier in the fractional reserve banking. So it is true that an awful lot of the money supply is not either in the form of actual physical currency, and a lot of it is in the form of deposits in banks.
And so then you pay interest on that loan. Where does that $1 million actually come from?
Well, the banks like to say that we get deposits first and then we make the loans based on the deposits. But it doesn't really have to work that way. If the bank happens to have excess reserves, it can just start making loans. So the banks do have a certain type of money creation power.
Anat?
The money creation, though, is a creation of numbers that flow through the economy, which is all fine. You can say that is just this payment system that I called an infrastructure. But it's not out of thin air in the sense that this is not new. This is new numbers that flow through the economy, which is all fine, which is great, which is useful. But it does not change the fact that they cannot invest money that they don't owe somebody. In some fashion. That fact remains. They are still a corporation with a balance sheet. That, in other words, with things they do and with funding that they get. The rest is just a way you aggregate certain numbers in the economy, but which is all fine, but it doesn't change the basic fundamentals of a bank as a business.
And that is Anat Admati, professor of finance and economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She's co-author of the new book, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. Timothy Canova is professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. And he's currently writing a book about the Federal Reserve. And we have a line open. So if you have any questions about the banking system, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for calling, Marco. Let's go next to Bill in Boulder Creek. Hi, Bill.
Yes, good morning. In America, we have a fractional reserve banking system. For example, if the fractional reserve ratio is 10 to 1, if you give a bank $10, they can loan out $90. And, for example, if you want to borrow $200,000 from a bank to buy a house, if you give them 10% down or $20,000 plus fees of, say, $7,000, then they can loan you the $200,000 based on just the money you gave them. So it's a good deal for the banks, but this is also called inflation.
All right.
If you care to comment on that.
Thank you. Tim or Anat, comment on that one?
Well, this is what I was referring to as fractional reserve banking, yeah. That if $1 million is deposited into Bank One, Bank One can then loan out, let's say, $900,000 of it because they have to keep a certain percentage as a reserve. But the money they loan out, that $900,000, it doesn't end there. That money then ends up getting deposited in bank 2, 3, 4, and it ends up expanding the money supply much more than the original $1 million that was first deposited in the first bank. It's not that the first bank turns around and makes $9 million of loans based on the $1 million of deposits. It works out over a period of time, and when you aggregate all of the loans and deposits that that happen as a result of that first initial deposit, it is many times more the initial amount of the deposit.
Anat, did you want to jump in?
Well, I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, yes, you can talk about all of those things, but I think fractional reserve and all of that makes it harder to understand at least what's wrong with banking than it needs to be. Because, you see, a lot of companies in the economy invest, and they invest all kinds of money. They invest board money, they invest equity money. Banks are the same. Now, there's a system there, and when they lend, the people do things with it, and it ends up being deposited in other institutions, or it ends up being invested elsewhere. So we have a whole system. That's okay. It doesn't. The fact that you count, that you do these fractional multiplications, is all fine and good, and money supplies and all these words are fine. It doesn't help you understand what's wrong with banking, is what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that what's wrong with banking is that they take too much risk with borrowed money. That's fundamentally what's wrong with banking. All throughout the time, too much risk with too much of it funded with borrowed money.
Tim?
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that statement. There have been economists over the years, however, Irving Fisher, I think, the University of Chicago economist during the 1930s and 40s, mm-hmm. Who favored 100% reserve ratio for banks, so banks could only lend. They'd have to keep in reserve 100% of what they lend, essentially.
They'll have to then.
The argument was that would make the system safer. I'm not advocating that here and now. I think that's a subject for a very long debate, not a short one. But other point is one that I agree with. It's very important to focus on the kinds of risks that we allow banks to take on.
I want to just, this is very related, this 100% reserve is very related to the Glass-Steagall thing, and I just wanted to throw in a comment. If banks had if they kept all your deposits, like it was like a suitcase deposit, you know, you give them a bill, they keep your bill right there. In that case, you know, they won't have as much money to lend, right? And the question is, how do they fund other investments? And this goes to the investment banking and to the notion of Glass-Steagall, because you see, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns were not commercial banks, and yet they were systematically important. The failure of Lehman Brothers ended up having collateral damage and creating a lot of ripple effect, domino effects to the economy, which we explain in the book. So the point is the following. The investment banks that you would separate from the commercial banks could be also very dangerous. And you cannot say, like they tried to say in UK as well, that we will have a ring fence, and if you do certain things, we'll just let you be and you're on your own and we'll let you fail. Because what if their failure has collateral damage that we're so scared of that we'll end up saving them? That's the problem with too big to fail. The problem with too big to fail might not even be that big. Part of it is big and complex, but the issue about it, the reason that somebody can't fail, and it could be relatively small but very interconnected, is that the failure would harm other, too much in the system would trigger, too much ripple effect would cause the system to collapse, would have impact on the economy.
And one more question about how the banks work, and then we'll get one more caller. What about the profits? Because in May, the FDIC reported that profits topped $40 billion in the first 3 months of the year. Mark Zandi, Moody's economist, said only 4 years after the banking system was literally looking into the abyss, it's highly profitable again. The biggest profiters, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Citigroup. And then in 1989, the CEOs of the seven largest banks earned an average of $2.6 million. Today, their income is about $26 million. So, Tim, how did this happen, and where did these profits come from?
Well, some of it is in the form of bank fees. That's, many billions of dollars in bank fees. But part of it is just the interest rate spread, where the bank's cost of funding is very low right now. And they're able to park their money in some safe investments in treasuries and use other resources for riskier investments such as derivatives. I think these profits are outlandish. The banking system has been supported by several trillion dollars of asset purchases by the Federal Reserve. And in that kind of a context, when the market has not really been working without those kind of props supplied by the central bank, it just seems outlandish to me that shareholders and bank executives are reaping a fortune right now.
And we don't have time to take Donald's call, Anant, but he and so many others want to know, what is the solution to this? You write about this in your book. What changes do you want to see?
Well, the profits are, a lot of them, as Tim was saying, you can break it to lots of different ways they make money. But one of the points about being profitable is that when you invest very, very little and you are able to pay your debts, then your profits are greatly magnified. That's the effect of leverage on the upside. Leverage meaning when you fund a lot with borrowed money, per dollar investment you get this leverage effect, which means that you can make, 1,000% all of a sudden if you just have a very, very little base on which, as long as it's on the upside. So when the interest rates are really, really low and they don't pass them on that easily to their, some of the mortgages are still paying them higher rates from before, the low interest rates are benefiting especially the banks. And so to look good in this environment doesn't take very much. When you have cheap funding like they do, it's not that hard. And when they have lots of fees and lots of derivatives and lots of other ways to go play, you can do very well. In our book, we have the example of a homeowner who borrows. Her name is Kate. And so we make a lot of the examples on a home borrower. And when she has her aunt guaranteeing her loan, life gets very, very good for her. Hmm. And she can make lots of money.
Well,
so the solution then, since you asked, if you want me to keep going.
We have just about 10 seconds.
Yeah, the solution is make them fund a lot more with equity. Make them retain their earnings and make them lend with money that's not borrowed as much. Much more than they do right now. It's in the single digits and it's far from the fortress they tell you it is.
That's Anant Admati, professor of finance and economics at Stanford. She's co-author of The Banker's New Clothes. Tim Canova is professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Center in Florida, and he's writing a book about the Federal Reserve. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's your call. What's on your summer reading list? On the next Your Call, we'll open the lines to get recommendations. What are your new and old favorites? Adobe Books in San Francisco was recently forced to relocate, and Marcus Books is fighting to stay open. So what's the state of independent bookstores, and which one do you support? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What books would you like to add to our reading list? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.